Thank you for downloading this podcast from the BBC of Forethought. The presenter is Ben Hammersley.
Welcome to the RSA and to Forethought, a series of talks offering a personal viewpoint. Tonight's speaker, Rob Hopkins, believes that engaged optimism is the best frame of mind in which to face the global challenges of the future, be it climate change, oil supplies running out, or general economic gloom. His solution lies in the so-called transition culture movement, of which he is the co-founder and which has as its first working example the town of Totnes in Devon. Here, all manner of community initiatives have bloomed to enable local residents to produce their own goods and services, reduce the need to use transport, and prepare the way for a post-oil future. He is the author of The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependence to Local Resilience, which, it's said, was voted the fifth most popular book taken on holiday by MPs during the summer of 2008. I wonder how many of them flew to get there. As he doesn't believe in taking planes, thanks to the railway, here tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is Rob Hopkins.
It's generally considered unwise to use props on radio, especially when it's your first appearance on Radio 4. However, this talk will contain two props, and this is the first one. It's a £10 note, but it's a Brixton £10 note, and it features David Bowie on the note rather than the Queen. I'll tell you more about it later, but it matters because it leads us into what I want to talk to you about tonight, which is the concept of community resilience. The former Crystal Palace football manager Ian Dowie once described resilience as bounce-back ability. In our own lives, in the lives of those around us, when we encounter difficulties, we either respond with resilience or we don't. Sometimes we're able to adapt, to enforce changes, to go with the flow, as it were, and at other times, everything falls apart. This applies to us as individuals, as communities, and as entire economies. The degree to which we are resilient matters very much. But one key question is, resilient to what? There's a conventional view of resilience, and then there's a very different one, which I want to talk about this evening. The UK Cabinet Office argues that it is up to each community to determine what they want to build resilience to, but then it sets out what it sees as being the key things. In this context, resilience is a very practical matter of ensuring that we have enough medicines, enough sandbags, and enough emergency responders in the event of a disaster. It's about the ability to adapt, the ability to be flexible. But I take a very different perspective to that, though, and I like to talk about, if we can coin a computer phrase, resilience 2.0. The World Economic Forum, whose job it is to advise world governments on risks, are very clear about what they see as being the three key risks. And they are energy price volatility, climate change, and the economic crisis. These require very different and more far-reaching responses, responses that go far beyond sandbags. And here's what I think we need to be building resilience to. Oil prices have quadrupled since 2003 and are becoming increasingly volatile. At the same time, North Sea oil production fell 22.5% last year, and the cost of importing oil into the European Union has risen from $280 billion in 2010 to over $400 billion in 2011. And it's clear that the rising price of oil can strangle any economic growth we might happen. Cheap energy underpins economic growth, and the two go hand in hand. And without cheap energy, globalisation goes into reverse. If petrol and diesel become more expensive, and if that teaches us anything, it's that far away really is quite far away. I found myself deeply worried about these issues and also the kind of world we were building for our children. I wondered whether seeing resilience just as being prepared for something meant that we were missing a trick, missing an opportunity. How might our settlements look if we began to think in terms of resilient food, resilient energy, and resilient economics? Might this shift in thinking actually contain the potential for an economic and cultural renaissance for the places that we live? That felt to me to be a very powerful question. So I looked around for people with whom we might be able to create an experiment, something that was based in the places that we live and that was where it started from. And I think as the economic unravelling continues to gather pace, it increasingly looks to me like the only idea on the table. So I want to tell you some stories from some of the places that you may not have heard of transition groups doing, I think, really quite extraordinary stuff that holds the seed of our economic future, a future which still trades, but mostly in things which can't be produced more close to home. A few months ago, I stood as the sun went down in a field in Norwich, visiting FarmShare, a community-supported agriculture scheme that was started by Transition Norwich, an idea that came out of their launch event about a year or so before. The farm now has 70 members and produces seasonal local produce for them. And they're creating a model which, until relatively recently, is what supported our towns and cities in terms of their food, growing food closer to where people live. It's been a steep learning curve, but there they are, modelling in practice a key part of a resilient, more local food system, learning a huge amount by doing so, and building a strong sense of community at the same time. And now to our Brixton Pound. 3 years ago, I stood in Lambeth Town Hall for the launch of the first Brixton Pound. It was an extraordinary event. All the traders came together, and it was a real celebration of Brixton and of its culture. The CEO of the local council stood up and said, "I want this to become the currency of choice for Brixton." The idea is that it's what they call money that sticks to Brixton. If you take it out of Brixton, it has no value. But in Brixton, it's about supporting local traders and supporting local businesses. They cannot be traded internationally, and they can't be lodged in offshore tax havens. More recently, they've introduced this new set of notes, and they've also launched a very innovative pay-by-text system where you can walk into a shop and text the shop owner and that's your payment done. The next development that's very exciting that'll be happening later this year in the city of Bristol is going to be the Bristol Pound, which will be a local complementary currency for the whole city, again with printed notes and mobile phone-based currency, keenly supported by the City Council. It's an experiment in what a resilient economy could look like in practice that could have huge repercussions elsewhere. At an event in Bath a while ago, I met somebody who told me about their plans, very excitedly about their plans, to set up a community energy company. And a few months later, Bath and West Community Energy was launched as a community-owned, community-run energy company. Recently, they raised £700,000 in a community share launch to put in place renewables in and around the city, which will be owned and run for the benefit of the community. They've started putting solar panels on local schools, but have much bigger and much more ambitious plans. And so to my second prop. This is a bottle of Sunshine Ale brewed by Harvey's Brewery in Lewes. It's empty, I'm afraid. I drank it. And it was very nice indeed. But it was brewed to celebrate the fact that the Ouse Valley Energy Service Company, a local energy company, which emerged from Transition Town Lewes, had raised £310,000 in shares from the local community and had covered the brewery in 544 solar PV panels. We're talking here about energy which is owned by the community and run for the benefit of the community. In November 2009, I went to Slathwaite in Yorkshire for an event which was called Transition North and brought together transition groups from all across the north of England. And in the hall at the back on the wall, there was a sign which said, "A fresh idea, a new community-owned fresh local food shop for Slathwaite." The local greengrocers was closing down and it was a very important part of the local economy. And people from Transition Marsden and Slathwaite groups had come together with other people as well and decided that they didn't want this shop to shut down, they wanted to keep it going. And they saw it as an important part of the regeneration of the local economy. Within a few weeks they'd raised £15,000 in shares and the Green Valley Grocery is now open for business and is doing very well indeed. Business is thriving, but the shop is more than just a shop. It's acting as a catalyst. They found quite early on, as people running a shop, that all the garlic they wanted to sell, for example, was imported from China. They started the Slathwaite Garlic Challenge, where anybody who came in to buy anything got given a couple of cloves of garlic and told to take home and plant it, and then when it's grown, we'll buy it back off you for the shop. That simple idea has grown now into a cooperative called Edibles, which is producing food to sell in the shop. And recently they, along with various other local food businesses, very publicly issued a declaration of independence from the global food system for the Colne Valley. A tad premature, perhaps, but it highlights the scale of their ambition. What we're seeing in communities around the country, whether they call it transition or not, is deeply exciting. It's enterprise, but it is enterprise in a context. They're implementing what Lloyd's wrote in a report about why businesses need to take oil depletion into consideration as a serious issue. They wrote, energy security is now inseparable from the transition to a low-carbon economy, and business plans should prepare for this new reality. They are going beyond this, though, and seeing this change of direction as a huge opportunity. They're not just creating standalone, one-off businesses, rather businesses emerging to meet what they see as a very real need to build community resilience. They are not hoping that the challenges outlined by the World Economic Forum will somehow simply go away. They are, without waiting for permission, rolling up their sleeves and getting on with it. Another key function that many of these enterprises offer is the ability for people to invest into their communities. I visit many of them at their launch events or other public events they've organised. These are ordinary people coming together in extraordinary times to do extraordinary things. To know and meet these people has been one of the greatest honours of my life. The recent review by Mary Portis on the High Street stated, a pound spent in a retailer with a localised supply chain that employs local people has a far greater domestic impact than a pound spent in a supermarket or national chain. What's more, out-of-town developments are often presented as major new sources of employment, but we need to recognise that this job creation is often just job displacement. Herein lies the tension. The current push for economic growth at all costs fails to determine between job creation and job displacement. It also fails to distinguish between strategies that build community resilience and strategies that undermine it. There is a big idea here, I think, a vital one, and I hope I've managed to excite you with its possibilities this evening. I often end talks with Arundhati Roy's quote, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." I think we might adapt her quote so that in the context of this bottom-up drive for more resilient communities, communities better prepared for uncertain times, it is not only a case of hearing another world breathing, but being able to see her around us, already setting up local businesses, reviving her local economy, setting up bakeries, breweries, food hubs, mentoring scores of young people with business ideas, attracting inward social investment finance, creating models whereby people can invest in their communities and see them being strengthened and supported. That's why I get out of bed in the morning, because I feel the potential of our getting this right is so exquisite that it's all I can do, and because the grim predictability of what will happen if we do nothing is unthinkable, especially in relation to the challenge of climate change. If we are able to turn things around on the scale we need to turn them around on, to replace oil vulnerability, carbon intensity, and fragility with resilience, it'll be an achievement our children will tell tales about, sing songs about. I hope I am there to hear them.
Thank you very much, Rob. We are here at the RSA in front of a live audience, all of whom I can see are dying to ask some questions. In fact, before I can even get my own question in, we have one right at the front of the audience.
Thank you for a fabulous, inspiring talk. I wondered if you had any sense of the number of transition towns throughout Great Britain, and having seen so many launch, if you have sort of top three tips for anyone planning to launch Transition Town.
Okay, so transition as an idea has been around for about 5 years, and there are now transition initiatives active in 34 countries, thousands of them around the world. I think in the UK it's 300 and something. Some of them are in towns, some are in cities. They're on all different kinds of scales. There are over 40 just in London alone. In terms of the things that are good to do when they get started, I think the first thing is to really work on the group, on making sure that you establish first thing how you're going to work together. You don't just dash out and start getting on with stuff. I think getting some practical projects under your belt quite early on just build a huge amount of confidence and belief in what you're doing. And I think the third thing is to have a sense of where it's going. So it's not just about small things that you do to get started, but you keep that long-term picture that what you're about is regenerating the economy, starting enterprises. So to start to think from that first stage of your transition initiative as a social enterprise.
Well, I have a question for you. These local currencies, which you showed us one very beautiful note from Brixton and spoke about others, how do they actually work practically? I go to the local shop, I pay with regular sterling. Do I receive my change in local currency?
That's one way it could happen. Generally, there would be a number of issuing points where you could take sterling and you could exchange it for local currency. And then you would go shopping with local currency in the shops that take it, so not all the shops would take it. Generally, the majority of locally owned shops would take it, and big chains generally wouldn't take it. And then you would go shopping. If you went shopping with 40 Brixton pounds, you would still come home with £40 worth of shopping. But what you would leave behind you is money that can only then be reinvested into local traders, local services, local produce. It's money that sort of circles more locally. It's like if you imagine an oil tanker, you know, if you have no bulkheads in an oil tanker, as soon as the sea gets rocky, all the oil starts sloshing about and you turn over very quickly. Local currencies are like bulkheads putting into an economy. They're money that can't get out. It just cycles locally but still makes things happen, which is ultimately what we want money to do.
So it can't be shipped off to the Cayman Islands and disappear into a tax haven somewhere?
Well, if it was, if somebody took a ship full of Brixton pounds to the Cayman Islands, then actually what would be great is they would get there and find they had no value whatsoever and that all that money they had invested, they had turned into Brixton pounds, would be staying in Brixton and helping the community and starting things happening there. So it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Hi, I was just wondering if you had any data or insight into why people might not want to use local currency.
I think one of the reasons is that sterling has the most fantastic amount of free advertising as currencies go. Every time you open a newspaper, everything is priced in sterling. You don't very often in Brixton open a paper and see a price that things are priced in Brixton pounds. There is a very, very slight kind of hassle factor that you have to go and change your money over and then go shopping with that, which I think the mobile phone-based thing sort of takes out of the equation. I think it's a new idea, and these things maybe they take a while to catch on. I think the currency that's emerging in Bristol and it'll be coming out, I think launched at the end of May, is going to be very interesting as a citywide thing with a lot of support from the council and something that really reflects Bristol and its culture and its traders and what people increasingly love about Bristol. So, and also, these things are all experiments. You know, I'm not standing here saying we definitely know how to do this. The whole thing with transition from the beginning is the idea that we have what we call the cheerful disclaimer, which says if you look at transition as a model and you think that's definitely going to work, this is an experiment. Getting involved in transition is an invitation to be part of that experiment, and that's how collectively how that knowledge is built up. So rather than researching and writing learned papers about complementary currencies, places are just trying it out, and we're drawing that experience together.
Question down here.
Actually, you may just have covered what I wanted to ask, but there is quite a substantial history of parallel currencies being created around the world in different circumstances, and a great many of those have led to quite negative repercussions in the long term, and I'm wondering whether anybody is actually looking at that history and trying to find a way of making sure that that doesn't happen with the new currencies that you're creating.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously there is a kind of, I mean, having just been very rude about people writing papers on the subject, I mean, there is a good body of academic research about local currencies and complementary currencies. And certainly these new currencies that are emerging very much look at that and draw from that. In Switzerland and Austria, they have some amazing regional scale currencies, which are being very successful, I think. And also, one of the things I think is very interesting looking back is in Argentina, when the economy collapsed completely in Argentina, that it was those local currencies that communities just started producing themselves were one of the key things that meant people actually got through that period in time. But certainly the new ones that are emerging learn as much as possible from what's gone before, absolutely.
As is the traditional BBC disclaimer, other complementary currencies are available. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Hopkins.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the BBC of Forethought. For our terms of use, please go to the Radio 4 website. The programme was presented by Ben Hammersley and the producer was Sheila Cook.